Hello and welcome. This is the Final Draft Podcast. My name's Andrew Popel. It is my enormous pleasure to be welcoming to the podcast today the 2023 Stella Prize winner, Sarah Holland Batt. Now, the Final Draft Podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. Every week, Final Draft broadcasts from the studios of 2SER in Sydney, and Final Draft is all about exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to established authors who, you know, you've just grown to love over the years. Each of these conversations is looking into the issues that drive that author's storytelling, a way to discover more from the books that you love, because these are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people, and I record on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, acknowledging that these are unceded lands and treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. Now, as I said at the top, it is just enormous pleasure, privilege to be welcoming Sarah Holland Batt to the show. Sarah has won the 2023 Stella Prize. This is a big deal. The Stella is an organization that celebrates and promotes books by Australian women and non-binary writers. The prize has been going for 11 years. It is a highlight. It is just incredible. And Sarah is going to be joining me to discuss her poetry collection, The Jaguar. So look, without any further ado, join Sarah and I discussing The Jaguar. It would be an understatement to say I am a little bit excited. If you have been paying attention to book news, you would know a little bit about Stella. Stella is an organization that celebrates and promotes books by Australian women and non-binary writers. They support greater participation in the world of literature. And in doing so, they create a more equitable and vibrant national culture. Of course, this all culminates in the annual awarding of the Stella Prize. As of speaking right now, that happened last night. And guess who I've got on the show? Welcoming the 2023 Stella Prize winner for her poetry collection, The Jaguar, Sarah Holland Batt. Insert cheering and clapping. Congratulations, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andrew. It's very exciting to be here.
It's really exciting to hype you up. And I love that you've got the time to join me. This is like, you know, a busy, busy period. But it's just gorgeous to have you here.
Thank you. And I'm praying that my voice will hold out.
Look, you won the prize last night. You are the queen of this moment. So you do whatever you need. Like if you fall asleep, we will press pause and we will come back to it. But while you are hale and hearty and riding high on the excitement, can you introduce this incredible collection, The Jaguar, to us?
Yeah, so The Jaguar is a book about in part about my father's experiences with Parkinson's disease. So Dad got Parkinson's when I was 18 years old, he had it for 20 years. He passed away in 2020. And the poems are an attempt, I think, to write about those sort of intimate and delicate experiences that you have caring for a loved one in their cognitive decline, in old age, which I think don't often make it into poetry. I had never read many poems about cognitive decline, about aging, about aged care before, but I found it to be such a profound life experience that I felt kind of compelled to write poems, you know, about it. It took me a long time to find the language for it and to think my way through, you know, how to write about these experiences in a way that might be fresh and interesting, I think, to the reader, because we do have quite a shopworn kind of cliche way of thinking about death and dying and aging as overwhelmingly negative experiences, things to be feared. And I wanted the poems to do something different and to open those experiences out as part of living, which they are. You know, death happens as we are living. It is part of our animal nature. It's part of what happens. The poems, I suppose, focus on that and particularly focus on the kind of week it took my father to die, which was, I mean, everyone who's listening to this will have experienced this with some loved one. There's sort of a mundanity to those hospital spaces. There's a sort of tedium to it. But there's also these kind of moments of profound kind of monumental wonder at what it is to be alive, what it means to die. In those poems in the book, I've tried to balance, you know, and capture some aspect of that. So that's sort of it. And then there are other poems in the book as the book progresses that are, you know, focused on my own life, relationships, and so forth. And I think thinking about that was, you know, to consider those as they continue. As you are watching someone die, so too you are living. And so, yeah, the poems in total balance life and death, I hope, you know.
Death is never easy to talk about. It's never easy to begin that conversation. I think sometimes those cliches that you talk about, we rely on them often because they are well-trodden ground. We don't have to explore that type of communication within ourselves. What did this writing do? Did you have to discover a new way for yourself to communicate? Were there forms you could rely on?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been thinking for some years now about this question of why it is that we're so reluctant to talk about death and dying, because, you know, it has flow-on effects, you know, denial of aging, denial of age, you know, and then you end up with ageism, you end up with fear. So I think it is important that we do find ways to think and talk about it. For me, it did take me some time to work out, I think, artistically and poetically, how to approach this subject matter and this territory in a way that was not already familiar, you know. And I think I'm suspicious of the idea of the poem as catharsis. I don't believe that poetry is like that for me. I wanted the poems to be something that a reader might get something from. It's not about me just expressing my emotions. It's also about shaping experience, you know, into language, turning it into an artifact, turning it into a work of art. And so I, you know, I ended up thinking quite a lot about that question of how the divide between the human and animal worlds, you know, this idea that humans are somehow separate from the natural world, where we're special. You know, we don't die the way animals die. You know, in a way, I think in our heads we believe we're eternal. There's such a profound denial of death, you know, that allows us to get on with our lives. So, yeah, the poems in the end, you know, one of the ways I approached it was drawing on animal imagery and positioning the human as part of, you know, the animal world, and the human death as part of the chain of, you know, animal deaths that happen all the time. But, yeah, it was challenging to kind of work through in my own mind what kind of images and what kind of metaphors and, you know, how to do this in a way that would be novel, because I think there are a lot of quite, you know, tired and shop-worn metaphors about death and dying. And the poet's task, I think, is to try and find a new path through that kind of shop-worn territory.
As you were speaking there, and a tangent, if you will, I'm going off sure. Pace with my script.
I love a tangent, yeah.
You were talking there about, I guess, kind of breaking down this notion of human exceptionalism. And I mean, it is something, it's very real. It's highly unacknowledged, you know, explicitly. It's responsible for so much damage in the world. Mm-hmm. And it is such a shame that one of the few things that really, you know, kind of tears down that facade for us is death, that we literally only start to come to terms with this when we face our own mortality. That it seems like, do you feel like you were able to, and maybe this is something reflecting on the conversations you've had about the collection, do you feel like you've started to break that down for people? Are people seeing, are people seeing this in the poems?
Well, I mean, the reaction to the book has actually been quite surprising, in that I worry that no one might want to read it, because I know there is this denial of this material. But what sort of slightly startled me as I went to festivals and so forth is the number of people who came up to share their own experiences. And I think there is this kind of freight that people carry of these very intense experiences about a subject that they know makes other people uncomfortable. You know, if you've, you know, when we ask someone, when we send our condolences to someone who's, you know, had a bereavement, often it doesn't extend much more than saying, you know, I'm thinking of you, sending you love. You know, we don't often open out a space to really ask people, how was that experience for you? You know, what have you taken from it? You know, tell me what happened. I think we're quite reluctant sometimes to hear those stories. So what was really beautiful was that, you know, a lot of people have come up to me, you know, as you're signing books, to tell me the stories of their own parents, of their own loved ones, of people they've cared for. And it made me realize that there's a reservoir, I think, of stories about this subject that people actually are actually keen to talk about once they've had that experience, but that culturally, you know, we don't really have a good common language, you know, to open those conversations out.
Yeah, we connect over things we share, and it feels, or it can feel like something that shouldn't be shared. It feels taboo. And so we have this very human need that is entirely unmet. And so we fall back to those cliches, as you mentioned at the beginning.
But, you know, I've found such solace myself in the few books, you know, the books that I've read that are about the similar territory. You know, it actually, I think, is both mysterious and so fascinating, this question of, you know, what is dying? What is a good death? What happens as we die? You know, and I think we would all live much happier lives if we could reconcile with our mortality. You know, when you are aware that one day you will die, I think you lead your life in a different way than if you suppress that knowledge, you know, and try and shove it to the back. And, you know, I think time is the most precious commodity that we all have, because it's going to end at some point. And so, you know, for me, the process of thinking about this, to come back to one of your earlier questions, I think has led me to a kind of reconciliation with my own mortality. It's something that I do think about. It's not always a comfortable thought, but I think it does, you know, quicken you to the stuff of life and to making sure that you're making the most of, you know, the time that you have, however that may be. And I think, you know, as you were saying, this myth of human exceptionalism is not only at the root of ageism, you know, this idea that, oh, people who die are somehow a different species and I'm not going to be like that and that won't happen to me, but, you know, so much else, you know, climate change, all of these huge issues that affect us globally, a lot of it can come down to this notion that somehow humans are exempt, humans are not going to suffer the consequences, you know, humans have the right to treat the world however we want because it's here for us. I think it's critical that we break that down. And I, you know, hope that in some way, certainly around the question of age, what it means to age and how we perceive older people, I hope the book, you know, makes some contribution to that conversation.
One of the wonderful things about talking about poetry, about sharing this love of literature or this form, is that I can ask you to read something on the show. It has these beautiful moments. If that is something I can ask of you, Sarah, to share something from The Jaguar.
Sure, I'd love to. So this poem is called The Gift. In the garden, my father sits in his wheelchair, garlanded by summer hibiscus, like a saint in a 17th century cartouche. A flowering wreath buzzes around his head, passionate red. He holds the gift of death in his lap, small, oblong, wrapped in black. He has been waiting 17 years to open it and is impatient. When I ask how he is, my father cries. His crying comes as a visitation, the body squeezing tears from his ducts tenderly, as a nurse measuring drops of calamine from an amber bottle, as a teen at the car wash wringing a chamois of suds. It is a kind of miracle to see my father weeping this freely, weeping for what is owed him. How are you? I ask again, because his answer depends on an instant's microclimate. His moods bloom and retreat like an anemone as the cold currents whirl around him, crying one minute, sedate the next. But today my father is disconsolate. I'm having a bad day, he says and tries again. I'm having a bad year. I'm having a bad decade. I hate myself for noticing his poetry, the triplet that should not be beautiful to my ear, but is. Day, year, decade, scale of awful economy. I want to give him his present, but it is not mine to give. We sit as if mother and son on Christmas Eve, waiting for midnight to tick over, anticipating the moment we can open his present together. First, my father holding it up to his ear and shaking it. Then me helping him peel back the paper, the weight of his death knocking. And once the box is unwrapped, it will be mine. I will carry the gift of his death endlessly. Every day I will know it opening in me.
Thank you. I thought, I was thinking a lot about what you were saying there about the way we think about ourselves as humans, human exceptionalism, the way we can both expand sort of infinitely and contracting. And it brought me in my thinking to William Blake and to see the world in a grain of sand, heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand. And the way those ideas, you know, it does. There is something of human exceptionalism in Blake's lines there, but it does also very naturally connect us. And yeah, that was beautiful. Thank you again. Thank you.
Such a pleasure.
Yeah, that was the other thing. You never talk about this, but when you invite poets on and they read their poetry, you then need to stop and breathe, and because that's just how it hits. That is how it hits. I imagine, where am I in my notes? Just come back to this. Talk. I'm going to rely on my notes just for a second, Sarah, because that really was beautiful and
very
affecting.
Oh, thank you.
Affecting.
Please do.
Look, I imagine the writing of the poems in the collection, they transformed your thinking. You are an artist. You are a craftsperson. Those words didn't just fall onto the page and then remain there unedited. So they've transformed your thinking. You've worked on this, but I wondered again, this incredible award that you've received, does all the recognition the poems are receiving, does that start to change your understanding of the collection again?
You know, I tend to think, I mean, awards are mysterious is the first thing I must say, in that I've been around long enough, you know, to see really amazing books pass unrecognized. You know, it is a beautiful recognition, and it is very meaningful, you know, when your peers recognize your work in your own time. But, you know, when you look through literary history, there are so many amazing writers whose works are still with us centuries later who went unrecognized. So I think you would be a fool to put too much stock in, you know, in this idea that winning a prize inherently means there's some, you know, particular reception that the work has to receive, you know. So for me, they're still very much the poems that I wrote, but it is beautiful and meaningful, and obviously quite personal. You know, the book is intimate. It is about my father and his death, and so there's something very moving, you know, to have the book recognized in that way. I mean, Dad was someone for whom books were transformative in his life. He grew up in England in the Second World War. He had a pretty rough childhood. His dad died in the war when he was 8. He was sent away from his alcoholic mother to a punitive English boarding school during the war, if you can imagine. You know, not an environment with a lot of human warmth, not a lot of love in his life as a young boy. But, you know, books and literature were where he found solace. And so, you know, he became quite evangelical about books for me as a father. He was always pressing them on me, telling me what to read, encouraging me to read, loved nothing more than having a dinner table discussion about a book that I'd read that he'd also read. And so there's something quite poignant. I mean, in a way, it's a book that I wish I never had to write, because I never wish those experiences on my father. But, you know, there is a special resonance, you know, in that Dad would love the fact that he is, in a sense, a character in a book. You know, he's there, he is in the poems. And then for me, it is really moving and meaningful on that personal level, because it is a personal book, you know.
Yeah. And the Stella, this is a personal feeling of mine, but I suspect it's one that is widely shared. The Stella is such a wonderful prize for what it has always set out to do and what it has grown into. And I wondered for you, I don't know if you've been asked about this or if you've considered it. It's only been 2 years that poetry has been eligible in the Stella. And in both of those years, a poetry collection has won. Of course, Evelyn Araluen's incredible Drop Bear last year. Do you have any thoughts? What do you make of this?
Look, I think it's great. And I think, you know, poetry is one of the oldest art forms on this continent. You know, Indigenous songlines and song poems have been around for tens of thousands of years. So, you know, poetry is very has always been central to meaning making in Australia. And so it is beautiful that the Stella recognises that and brings poetry, you know, into the conversation with other literary works. And I think, you know, at times poetry has been slightly sidelined or thought of as a separate kind of boutique esoteric kind of operation, and it's not that. In fact, poems, you know, speak very directly to experience and are very, you know, immediate forms of art. And so I'm thrilled that the Stella, you know, and I think increasingly in other ways poetry is making inroads in our culture, which is fantastic. There's certainly an extraordinary volume of important and exciting new work being published at the moment too. So I'm not enormously surprised that, you know, poets are having good success. I think, you know, in both years on the long list, on the short list, you know, and I think that's exactly what poetry, I think, in Australia has always wanted, is to be part of the literary conversation, not sort of distinct from it or a separate sub kind of category.
And that relationship. In Fishing for Lightning, another terrific book, just not the one we're celebrating today, dear reader, Fishing for Lightning is an incredible collection of Sarah's writing from the pandemic discussing incredible Australian poetry. In your introduction, you describe poetry as full of freedom and possibility, and the relationship between the poet and the reader as something of a conspiracy. I love that. Does this speak to why you're a poet? Is this scope, but also this tight relationship with your audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think I love poetry as a form. Obviously, it's the form I've chosen to pursue. And I get asked quite often why that is, because I think some people are totally mystified as to why you'd be a poet in Australia in 2023. But
money, you know, and that is their love.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, but there's also, for me, I like the fact that every new poem is completely blank artwork when you start it, and that you shape language into the precise kind of configuration that becomes the final form of the poem. And I'm fascinated by, I think poems leave the door open for the reader to contribute, and I think that's what I find very exciting. I think prose and novels often there is an openness, but in general, there's such control of your attention. There's not the silences and gaps that a poem has. You know, every line of poetry has a little silence at the end, a little moment of hesitation before you round the bend and get to see how that line continues or how the next thought, you know, unfolds. And I think in the silences in the poem, the reader, you know, there's always an anticipatory kind of reading because of the structure of the line. Like the primary unit, the primary thing that distinguishes poetry from other forms of writing from prose is that it's arranged in lines. They're little units of thought. And then the reader, you know, puts those little units of thought together. And I love that the poem is a kind of universe, a little tiny universe in of itself. And there's always an implied, you know, pre-poem moment, and there's always an implied after. And I think the reader, you know, just gets this utterance that kind of comes out of silence, ends in silence. And I love that there's that space for the reader to enter and imagine the world of the poem. So that does that kind of answer your question? That's certainly what draws it, you know, draws me to poetry.
I hope so. I mean, I asked you and only your answer could be correct, because it could only be you. You also... I do love the deliberation and the deliberateness of a poem. And I think also it's also in that introduction you talk about poetry being perhaps considered difficult, but the relationship that a new reader or a less familiar reader can grow into as they read poetry, and the way that I think can change expression, or perhaps change the way we think about expression. And I want to bring it back to the collection, to this wonderful collection, the Jaguar, that we are celebrating alongside you today, Sarah. As I read the beautiful sequence towards the end, at the end of the collection, In My Father's Country, I got a real sense of the power and the slipperiness of memory. The sequence, it's a narrative arc, or there is a narrative arc to these poems, as you trace your father's life, your relationship with each other. But the scenes and the moments, they pulse and seem to feed off each other, revealing, I guess, a sense of the complexity of a love that's built over a lifetime. I wondered about this because, of course, I read so much of prose narrative and the way it progresses. Does poetry give you a power to perhaps capture memory in a way? What I've written on the page is, in a way, linear narrative perhaps can't. But what I actually mean is, does poetry give you a power to capture memory, perhaps in the way that we more truly experience memory?
I think that's the perfect question. And I think that is the answer, that, you know, the poem has such capacity for discontinuity and sort of juxtaposition of different time frames. And I think the poem can bring those things and coalesce them, you know, together in ways that can be quite startling. And so, you know, I like that question of the time scales of the poem. You know, some poems are just really intense moments of narration of a single scene. And, you know, probably the poem that I've read on this program earlier, The Gift, is a poem of a single scene mostly, where it's just, you know, there's a sense of a vignette and that's what the poem does. But, you know, I also love that the poem can have, because the poem's, you know, composed of little stanzas where there are breaks between them, there are line breaks, there is the capacity, I think, for the poem to shift ground and to move incredibly quickly through time and space, at the poet's will. That is, you know, that can happen in prose. I don't think there's no particular power that is distinct in the way that poetry can do that from prose. But I would say, because of the poem's brevity and because of that sense of there being no extraneous information, not a word that's not necessary, I think the poem tends to do it in a more charged and intense and condensed way than prose generally does. And certainly for me, I think about that often, about the way the poem construes memory, the way the poem can bring together discontinuous memories together. Mm. And that very much is my experience of a memory of a person. I don't have in my head a linear memory of my dad's life. There are moments, you know, that come to you at different points in time that take on particular resonance. There are things that had happened that I hadn't thought about for years, but after Dad died, all of a sudden took on a particular charge or kind of, you know, luminosity that make you see them anew. And I think that's very much what memory is. It's a sort of re-wallpapering. Every time you're remembering something, you're actually inventing or twisting or changing elements of it. And I think the poem does have, for me, the capacity to kind of capture that complexity.
Yeah, and no shade on prose, because there's a lot of prose love happens on Final Draft, but I do want to I just want to continue with this, because again, a word you use in Fishing for Lightning, I think, for poetry is explosion and exploding, and I particularly like the idea that in memory making, which I think you do so wonderfully, memory are these little explosions. I had this experience recently where I visited somewhere that I hadn't been since before the pandemic, and it was like having my entire life rush in on me, this experience of returning. And there are these mini explosions, which in the word are sudden and destructive, but the power of memory, and I think what you have done and the power of poetry, is you then give them sequence, you give them rhythm. You have to make them cohesive, because it's impossible to live if we don't make these things cohesive, but they are so inherently disruptive. I felt that in the sequence in My Father's Country, and that sequence, and I feel that so often in poems. Their ability to make sense of chaos.
Yeah, and I think poems, you know, ideally do that, and they do that for someone else, and that's the trick of the poem. Is in a way a poem, you know, if I read a poem of, I don't know, Emily Dickinson's, I'm summoned into a scene in her imagination, you know, and it's an incredible kind of trick of the poem that you know, you turn the page and all of a sudden this little world is there kind of turning, and you're kind of transported to it. And I think, you know, that I remember there's a beautiful quote by Emerson where he says something about, he describes genius as our own thoughts. You know, when we read a work of genius written by someone else, he says it's as though our own thoughts have been returned to us with a certain alienated majesty, which I love. But, you know, it's that idea of, you know, you recognize something that is both something you've never personally thought of before, but you almost feel as though it's your own thought. And I think that that kind of tension between possession, and it's almost a sort of sense of creating the poem as you read a good poem. You know, you feel like you are part of the creation of that scene. I think that's the work of poetry that, that interests me, and that I feel that, you know, other poets help me make sense of my own world and my own experiences. And that's what you hope, I think, in writing a poem, in a sense, you're hoping that it will both, you know, perhaps clarify your own memory or become, you know, a means of understanding your own experience in language, but you also hope that somehow it will do that for someone else. And I think that's always the challenge, isn't it, to make the poem connect, even though it is personal, even though it draws on your own experience and your own, you know, imagination, your own language, that somehow that will resonate, you know, in the echo chamber of someone else's mind.
Perhaps it's appropriate then, Sarah, to thank you as a reader and to thank you on behalf of readers for that clarifying experience and that alienating experience, and just for this wonderful, wonderful collection. I am speaking with Sarah Holland-Batt. She is the 2023 winner of the Stella Prize. It's only been, as we speak, it's only been 24 hours. So expect this to get more exciting. Sarah, please expect this to get more exciting. And thank you. Thank you for including Final Draft in this celebration.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. It's been such a pleasure to be on Final Draft and to have a chat.
Thank you for joining me today, and thank you again also to Sarah Holland-Batt. Sarah's poetry collection is The Jaguar. It is the 2023 Stella Prize winner. Now, the podcast is recorded on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. The show is presented and it's produced by Andrew Popel. Stay in touch. Like, I would love to hear from you. I would love to know what's going on in your reading life. You can find Final Draft on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. But if you could also maybe drop me a comment, maybe give the show a rating, a way for you to let me know what you think, but also to help others discover great Australian writing here on Final Draft. I am Andrew Popel. I will be back again with more great conversations from incredible Australian authors here on Final Draft. But of course, till then, and as always, happy reading. Bye for now.